from KCPW in Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. It's one of Salt Lake City's most desirable areas, but part of the Yale Crest neighborhood has a problem. The groundwater near 700 South and 1600 East contains high levels of PCE, shorthand for tetrachloroethylene. Officials suspect it's a byproduct of a former dry cleaner in the neighborhood. They first discovered the plume back in 1990, and they've been monitoring it ever since. But now EPA officials say the plume is likely to grow, endangering public drinking water. And they say it's time to clean it up. Today on the program, we're talking about what Superfund designation would mean for residents and businesses in the area. Plus, an online project to make public records more accessible and meaningful. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Contaminants from a former dry cleaner are seeping into the groundwater on the east side of Salt Lake City, so much so that the EPA is now proposing the site for Superfund status. Today on the program, we're finding out more about the PCE plume at 700 South and 1600 East and the proposed cleanup project. And joining me in studio is Renee Zollinger. She is the environmental manager for Salt Lake City. And Renee, good morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Good morning, Jennifer.
Also with us, Dale Urban. He is the Site Assessment Section Manager for the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. And Dale is in studio with us as well. Dale, good morning.
Good morning.
Also joining us by phone, Ryan Dunham. He is the Site Assessment Manager for Region 8 of the Environmental Protection Agency. And he's joining us by phone from EPA's regional headquarters in Denver. Ryan, good morning to you.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
The public can submit comments on the proposed PCE plume by November 13th, and we'll give you some more details on that as we go. Later on in the program, we'll learn more about the Utah's Right to Know project, an online database by the Salt Lake Tribune. But first, what Superfund cleanup means. If you live in the Yale Crest neighborhood, what do you want to know about Superfund designation? Or if you've lived through a Superfund cleanup yourself, how did it affect your life or livelihood? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Ryan Dunham from the EPA, I'd like to start with you. Just what is PCE, tetrachloroethylene?
PCE is a chlorinated solvent. It is typically used in dry cleaning operations and as a degreaser in a lot of machine and automotive type industries. It's a type of compound that's considered a volatile organic compound, meaning it prefers to be a gas rather than a liquid. And in the, you know, when it's released into the environment, it's also known as a sinker, which means it has the tendency to drop and sink through the soils, and it can get into the groundwater fairly easily.
Hmm. So what does exposure to PCE do to people or to animals or even to landscaping? I mean, what if I drink it, or what if my dog drinks something with PCE in it?
Sure. Well, it depends on what level of PCE you're exposed to. Higher concentrations like you'd see in occupational settings, you know, this can result in dizziness, headaches, nausea, even unconsciousness. But the levels we're seeing at this site, which are relatively low, the concerns are those long-term effects, particularly PCE has been classified by the Department of Health and Human Services as a potential carcinogen. So that would be the main concern that we'd have at these low levels that we're seeing.
Renee Zollinger, describe the area of Salt Lake City that we're talking about. Where is this PCE plume?
Well, based on the data we have so far, it looks like the source starts up at around 700 South and 16th East, and it is continuing to the west, southwest, down into the area around 8th South, between, you know, 5th South and 8th South and 11th East and 13th East is kind of where the end of the plume that we found so far is.
Is this considered to be a big plume?
To me, it seems big compared to other plumes we've seen in Salt Lake City, but I don't know nationally or even statewide.
Dale Irwin, maybe you can help us out on that question. I mean, is this, I don't know, your average groundwater contamination plume?
It's a fairly large size plume that's affected quite a few acres. It's estimated it's impacted about a geographical area of anywhere from 200 to 300 acres. So it's a fairly good size plume, and it appears that it's got the potential to even grow bigger, which is a concern to us.
But Ryan Dunham from the EPA, you say that it's not a major contamination. There are still relatively low levels of PCE in this plume.
There are relatively low levels of PCE that we're seeing in the shallow groundwater, which is really a concern for us. And that's kind of the new exposure pathway that's come to light in recent years. And that's a concern. Having PCE that close to the surface is a concern because of indoor inhalation exposures to the process of vapor intrusion. In the deeper groundwater, we have orders of magnitude higher concentrations of PCE. But it's really those ones at the shallow, those detections at the shallow, in the shallow groundwater, that are a big concern for us.
Huh. Is it also a concern that this is primarily a residential area?
Well, it is definitely a concern that it's in a heavily residentially populated area.
Dale Urban, I understand that high levels of PCE were first detected in this neighborhood, in this area, in 1990. How and where was it discovered for the first time?
That's correct. It's my understanding that back in the early 90s, it was first discovered at the Mount Olivet Cemetery irrigation well as part of a routine testing program. And it came to our attention at that point in time. It was then discovered under the CERCLA program.
What is that, CERCLA?
That's the Comprehensive Environmental Liability and Compensation Act. And what that does is allows the state to use federal funding to investigate the source of that contamination. Where's it coming from? You know, it's not coming from the cemetery itself. And so we looked at nearby potential sources, and that's when it was first described or listed as the 700 South 1600 East PCE plume, and then subsequently that part of the investigation was closed out.
Mm. Where do you think the contamination is coming from?
Well, based on the most recent sampling that we did starting in 2011, after the detection was found in 2010 in the Red Butte Creek area, we conducted the investigation, and the same type of contamination that was surfacing in residential springs was the same type of contamination that we had seen previously at the 700 South 1600 East plume, or 1600 East plume, and it looked like the most viable source was the VA hospital. And so we've reverted the listing or the description of the site. We've taken it back from the Eastside Springs back to the 700 South 1600 East plume, because we do believe it's connected, and it's just a continuation of that previous plume that has since migrated further down gradient to the west.
Why is it taking 20 years to address this? If you got a red flag in 1990, I guess I'd put that question to you, Ryan Dunham from the EPA. I mean, is it because it's spreading, or the concentrations are becoming higher, or it's becoming closer to a groundwater situation?
Kind of like I said previously, back in the 90s and in the early part of 2000, we thought this was limited to the deep groundwater, and the city, through their routine testing and monitoring, had really limited any potential exposure pathways through drinking water. But it was the discovery of these springs and PCE in the shallow groundwater that's, you know, really got our attention and is really driving the concern and the need for more detailed investigation, because we do have that vapor intrusion potential.
Mm. Renee Zollinger, how is Mayor Ralph Becker thinking about this contaminated area?
Well, the mayor and the city council are both very concerned that we have contamination that isn't fully understood. We don't know yet the exact extent of it. We don't know how it's affecting or impacting people. And both the mayor and the city council have expressed a strong desire and commitment to finding out how people are affected so that we can make sure our community is protected.
Hmm. Describe for us just how the contamination area is changed. Renee, is that something you can address?
Well, I can address it from the aspect of our public utilities department. Our public utilities department, which supplies the drinking water for the city, has a number of wells and springs that they sample routinely, and they've sampled them over the course of decades, and we never saw water contamination in those springs or any of the artesian wells down to the west. And this year, or in 2010, when we sampled those springs and saw PCE for the first time, we were very concerned that what we had hoped was a stable plume was actually moving to the west and could jeopardize, other water supplies as well as the shallow water in people's yards.
What do you mean by stable plume?
A plume, when you asked earlier, is this a large plume or a small plume, most plumes get to a certain size where they don't really grow or expand any further. They're kind of degrading at the edges at about the same rate they're moving. So they become stable. They don't really change much in shape at a certain point. And I think originally when we found this deep groundwater back in the early 2000 time frame, everybody was hoping that plume had reached its maximum size, that we weren't going to have any surprises with it moving toward other wells or other supplies. So finding it further to the west just 10 years later gave us the information that indeed it was actually expanding in size.
And Dale, I imagine that state DEQ was a little concerned about that expansion as well.
Well, definitely. And as part of our investigation, we sampled two additional artesian wells, the Liberty Park well and the 8th South, 5th East well, just to ensure that those were still not impacted by the plume. And those came back clean. And those are routinely, as Renee mentioned, those are routinely tested by public utilities to ensure that they're safe for the residents to continue to drink. But it is a concern that it is moving and it has the potential to impact additional groundwater resources. Hmm. And so that's what we want to prevent.
Ryan Dunham from the EPA, your report says that left unaddressed, the 700 South, 1600 East PCE plume is likely to grow in size. Describe for us just how plumes grow. I mean, I would think that I know nothing about water and the way that, but my instinct says, that a concentration would become more diluted by being exposed to more water. Does that make sense?
It does, but these plumes can grow with the flow of groundwater. And also if you have a pool of this contaminant, concentrated and pooled up somewhere, that can essentially act as a feeder source for this plume, and it'll give off dissolved phase contaminants, and it can continue to expand that way.
So it doesn't lose its strength as it is exposed to more water, is what you're saying?
That's correct. If you have a pool of the stuff that's, built up over time, a big source of it, accumulated somewhere on top of a clay layer or confining layer in the ground where it's pooled up, it can continue to release dissolved phase contaminants.
We're speaking with Ryan Dunham. He is with the Environmental Protection Agency Regional 8. Also with us, Dale Urban, Site Assessment Section Manager for the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, and Renee Zollinger. She is the Environmental Manager for Salt Lake City. We're talking about a PCE plume, some groundwater contamination on the east side of Salt Lake City. The EPA is suggesting that this area become a Superfund cleanup site, and they're asking for public comment. The public can submit comments on the proposed PCE plume by November 13th. You can see all of the public records on the plume at the Salt Lake City Main Library on Level 3 here on Library Square. And you can also mail comments to the EPA's CERCLA docket office. That's at 1200 Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20460, or you can call 202-566-0276. We have lots of links and more information on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about just what a Superfund site is, what the cleanup would mean for people in this neighborhood, you can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. What does it take to clean up contaminated groundwater? And what would Superfund designation mean for property owners and for property values on Salt Lake City's east side? Today on the program, we're talking about a proposed Superfund cleanup of groundwater under about 300 acres in Salt Lake City's Yale Crest neighborhood. My guests include Renee Zollinger. She is the environmental manager for Salt Lake City, Dale Urban with the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, and Ryan Dunham with the Environmental Protection Agency. And we invite you to join us as well. The EPA is asking for public comment on the proposal through November 13th. You can see documents on the issue at the Salt Lake City Main Library, or you can check out links to the EPA, the DEQ, as well as Salt Lake City on our website, kcpw.org. If you've got questions, if you live near the 700 South, 1600 East PCE plume, or if you've lived through a similar Superfund cleanup in your neighborhood, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Ryan Dunham with the EPA, just what does a Superfund cleanup mean? I mean, what does it take to do a cleanup?
Well, Superfund, in essence, is just a designation that these sites are given, which triggers a federal mandate to get these sites cleaned up. So once you're on this list, there's a requirement that these sites be further investigated and cleaned up. And it also unlocks the resources, both financially and technically, with technical expertise to study these problems in more detail and evaluate technologies which can be used to remediate them.
Are you digging up pipes? Are you digging up people's yards? I'm just trying to visualize what exactly the cleanup entails.
You know, it's difficult to speculate at this point in time. You know, it's really based on site conditions and the outcomes of that remedial investigation and feasibility study that will take place. But there are a range of technologies, because we have a groundwater plume, a lot of them are probably less intrusive than if we had, you know, waste piles or drums or something to that effect. Here, different technologies are out there, like pump and treat and air sparging and different types of chemical oxidation and bioremediation, which can transform these chemicals into less toxic substances. So there's a range of technologies that are at our disposal, but it really just depends on the site-specific conditions, the geology, the hydrology, those sorts of things.
And I imagine until you get your hands dirty, you know, until you start to dig into this, you can't really say how long it would take.
That's correct.
Okay. Why is this an EPA issue, Dale Urban? Why wouldn't the state take this on as a cleanup project?
Well, the most simple answer to that question is the state simply lacks the financial resources to take on something of this magnitude. By requesting federal funding, we leverage that resource to enable us, as Ryan said, not only to determine the entire extent and degree of the contamination, you know, define the scope of the problem, but also to evaluate alternative cleanup options and then come up with the best alternative for the site contamination and the problem areas. But the state, I mean, we're talking millions of dollars. And as you know, state resources are very limited, and the legislature is always looking to reduce budgets, not increase them.
And I would assume that resources is why Salt Lake City also would be turning this over to the EPA. This is not a problem the city could handle internally.
That's correct. And in fact, for Salt Lake City, our environmental resource is the Salt Lake Valley Health Department. So when we first detected this in 2010, we turned to the Salt Lake Valley Health Department, and they helped us get the word out, and they looked at their programs. But they don't have the program or the resources to do this kind of an assessment. So they went to the state, who went through their programs to see if it qualified for any funding. And again, we did not come up with any kind of programmatic resources for it. Hmm. So that's the point at which we involved the EPA and asked them for assistance.
Jim called from Salt Lake City, couldn't stay on the line, but his question is, between 700 and 800 South and 1200 and 1300 East, he says there's a stream that runs near Elizabeth Street, and he wanted to know if that was part of this PCE plume. Renee, you're looking at your map.
I am, and it very well could be. There are a lot of springs that daylight out of the hill that everybody's familiar with coming down off the bench. It's because of the geology and hydrology and the fault, it's very complex. So that stream may come from the plume area, or it may come from a different direction, and that's the kind of assessment that needs to be done.
Okay. Jim, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We're talking about contaminated groundwater, a plume of PCE on the east side of Salt Lake City near the Yale Crest neighborhood. If you've got questions or comments about just what designating that area as a Superfund site would mean, 801-355-TALK. 801-355-8255. Renee Zollinger, I understand you've held a few public meetings on this. You've circulated flyers. You've put it on your online discussion forum called Open City Hall. But really, there's been very little public comment or outcry. Why do you think that is?
I don't know. We have certainly asked ourselves that. We've tried to make sure that we've done everything we can to let people know. Including going door to door with letters and mailers, letting people know about what we've found and how we think that we could proceed to evaluate this. We did have three very well attended community council events, and I think a lot of people got their questions answered there. But the mayor and the city council really want to know how the public feels about this. They want to accurately reflect the community's opinions and desires, which is why we've posted this on Open City Hall. So people can go to slcgov.com/Open City Hall and weigh in with their opinion, read what their neighbors think, and the city council and the mayor can use that that input when they form their opinion and support for this process during the next few months.
And we should make clear that the comments that are submitted on Salt Lake City's website are not submitted officially to the EPA request for public comment, right?
That's correct, and thank you for pointing that out. We certainly want people to let EPA know so that EPA can respond to any of their ideas, comments, or concerns. And we do not have the ability to submit anything from Open City Hall onto EPA. So people will need to go to the EPA website directly in order to submit those comments.
Ryan Dunham from the EPA. So the public is welcome to comment on a Superfund designation for the next 55 days or so. I don't know. It's a 60-day limit. Just why does the public need to weigh in on this issue? Why do you think that's so important?
It's important to get public feedback because I think in order for Superfund process to be successful, you know, we want community involvement, community engagement, and we want to know what people's opinions and thoughts are on, you know, having a site listed in their neighborhood. So it's important for us to get that feedback from the community so when we go out to the communities after the site's proposed, we can engage them in a constructive and productive way and get their feedback and hear their concerns.
This caller, Becky from Salt Lake City, also couldn't stay on the line, but Becky has a few questions. First off, what's the difference between groundwater and drinking water? Dale Urban, you want to take that one?
Well, there's different kinds of groundwater in the Salt Lake Valley. And basically, the drinking water typically comes from the deep confined aquifer. And what we're looking at on the east bench is the recharge area, and some of that, you know, the creeks, those are obviously used for drinking water as well. Some of the shallow groundwater has got high total dissolved solids or high TDS, and so it's not used primarily. And the shallow groundwater I'm talking about, you know, the 0 to 30, 50 feet. What we've got here is kind of a mix of actually it's groundwater in the recharge area. What we found in the...
What do you mean by recharge area?
Just as the snow melts and it percolates down through the soil, it enters into the groundwater and then it recharges or adds to the volume of water that way. The groundwater that we found at the at the original investigation area in the 7th South, 1600 East Plume back in the 90s. When the monitor wells were drilled then, the groundwater was at a depth of, I believe, about 140 feet deep, but it also extended down to, you know, the 200 to 300 feet depth. And that's where you're getting that mix into the deeper drinking water area. And in fact, there's a well at 5th South, I believe it's Salt Lake City well number 18, that was taken offline because that has shown detections of PCE. Mm. And so we do have an actual impact to a drinking water well, and that was below the federal standard of the Safe Drinking Water Act of 5 parts per billion. But as a precaution, Salt Lake City Public Utilities took that offline. But that's, again, that's why that's a concern we have, is that it is, because it's a dense non-aqueous liquid, it's a sinker, as Brian said, it's migrating downwards and not just staying shallow at the surface. And so it's got that potential to move from shallow groundwater down to the deeper aquifer, which is the drinking water.
Hmm. And Jennifer, yes, if I could add, it's maybe interesting to people that 65% of the drinking water in Salt Lake City actually comes from surface water. So when you're driving by those reservoirs up in the mountains, that's by far more than half of your drinking water. And Salt Lake City has a system of wells and reservoirs, most of which are not down here in the valley, but are further up toward the hills. And the city does a tremendous amount of testing to make sure that there's no contaminants coming in from any of those sources before they blend that and deliver it. So we know that the drinking water is not impacted by this plume or other plumes at this time.
Hmm. Becky's second question, can residents do home testing of the, if they've got a little creek or something, or I don't know, can are you asking for residents to be an active part of this investigation, Renee?
I think that we understand that people want to do to take measures. We want people to be proactive. People want to make sure that they're not being exposed. These tests are very specific. They require a lot of precision in how they're sampled. The labs that you use are important. So this isn't necessarily as easy as buying a radon test down at Home Depot and running it. And so if somebody feels like they really want to do the testing, I think they need to consult with a professional sampler or a consultant that can help them do it correctly, because otherwise they'd be spending their money on data that may not be very good. And one of the things that I know EPA is trying to do is make sure that this process moves quickly so that we can get answers to people, so they don't feel like they need to go out on their own and protect themselves, but that this investigation is going to come in and support them quickly.
Ryan Dunham, do you want to weigh in on that? Home testing, residents going out there and sampling their on their own, probably not advised, I guess, at this point?
I would agree with everything Renee just said. It can be expensive to do that on their own. They need to make sure it's done correctly. At the levels we're seeing, concentration-wise, we don't think it's an emergency situation where someone needs to act immediately. It's certainly within their prerogative to do so if they want to go that route. But at these lower levels, it's not an imminent emergency situation. So, you know, we're trying to work as fast as we can on our end to get this remedial investigation started and underway, and we can hopefully answer some of those questions for them sooner than later.
A final question from Becky is, why wouldn't this area want to be a Superfund site? I mean, are there downsides? Are there alternatives to Superfund designation? Ryan?
Well, you've certainly heard a lot of people bring up the issue of the stigma with Superfund and the, you know, effect on property values. We don't necessarily see it that way at EPA. You know, we think that the health risks and trying to get a better understanding on those definitely outweigh the effects on property values, but we understand that that is a concern. We also think that, you know, it's more so the contamination that drives that stigma, and that's been well documented. It's not so much the designation on this list. So by addressing that contamination and getting this problem solved and eliminating that uncertainty regarding, you know, the health effects. We think that can actually have a positive effect on property value. So that would be one of the main ones that you hear brought up with Superfund.
Hmm. Dale Urban, in the places that have had a Superfund designation throughout the state, I mean, have you seen property values drop? Have you seen some negative effects to this kind of a designation?
I think historically it's been more of a initial perceived negative effect, but ultimately the property values, the real estate market and the bankers and the people know that, yeah, there is contamination there, but it is being addressed by a regulatory agency and it is being cleaned up. And as Ryan said, that's going to help rebound property values instead of keep them low. If, on the other hand, you know, if people know that there's contamination on their property or below their property and nobody's doing anything about it, that's where the problem really lies. That's what negatively impacts the property values from our perspective as a state and looking at Superfund sites. The most recent example would be like Flagstaff Davenport up by the Lakai and Cottonwood areas. That's property value certainly hasn't decreased there, at least not that I know of.
And Renee, you're nodding.
That's correct. It does appear that from the city's perspective, we think it leaves people holding the bag if they have a property that's contaminated and nobody to take responsibility for it, nobody to clean it up, and no programs. And you asked, Jennifer, what's the alternative to Superfund? And we did a pretty extensive look at that because we wanted to be sure that we understood what all our options were as a city. And we did not find any satisfactory option for investigating this, understanding it, or addressing it outside the Superfund program.
Hmm. Becky, I hope that answers all of your questions. Thanks very much for the call. Our time is running short. If people want to weigh in on this, Ryan Dunham from the EPA, what's the preferred method? Through email, through snail mail? Should they call you? How do you want to hear from the public?
Well, I think the best way right now is through our formal comment period. If they want to, you know, review the documents that are out there and kind of form their own opinions and send us comments that way. I think the most effective way is probably through the regulations.gov website, where you can just submit comments online. There's also an email address, and that information is on our website, and I take it it's on yours as well. And then I would say, you know, the online form that Salt Lake City has set up to the Open City Hall is a good way to get your opinions and issues out there and heard.
If somebody wants to talk to a live body, will there be someone to answer some questions on the phone?
Sure. My telephone number is on our website, as well as our community involvement coordinator, and we've got some of the contacts over at the state on there as well.
And Dale Urban, I'm wondering if the state is getting some feedback. Are you? I mean, the public comment period just opened, but are you hearing from people yet?
Well, we have been invited to, as Renee mentioned, three different community council meetings: the Yale Crest Community Council, East Liberty Park, and East Central. Over the course of the last 3 months, July, August, and September, so we have had that interaction, that request. We've got a request from the parents of Rowan Hall School to meet with them this Thursday. So yeah, we are getting some requests and some positive feedback from the local community, but we haven't been inundated by a lot of calls, and that's kind of surprising to us. But I think people were aware of the 7th South 1600 East Plume back in the 90s and 2000, and now it's kind of come back around full circle, and I think they've got kind of used to the fact that, yeah, there's something there, it's not going away. We've looked at other options. I believe the city looked at other federal grants back in the 2004-2005 era. Those didn't pan out. So, you know, congressional earmarks or other federal grants didn't come to fruition. And so basically it's come full circle, and people have come to they've come to the opinion that, like it or not, this is the best alternative that we could have to actually define the scope of the problem and then address it and come up with a good, viable, cleanup alternative, and let's take care of it. Let's be done with it, and let's restore the community.
And Renee, that's what Salt Lake City's thinking. This is the best option, a Superfund designation.
Yes, right now that's the only option that we see, and we see a lot of positives in that program. So we're supportive of it right now.
Renee Zellinger, she is the environmental manager for Salt Lake City. Renee, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer, for having me.
Dale Urban with the Utah Department of Environmental Quality. Dale, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And Ryan Dunham with the EPA. Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, the public can submit comments on the proposed PCE plume by November 13th. You can view the public records on the plume at the Salt Lake City Main Library on Level 3. And you can also email comments or mail comments to the EPA on this environmental cleanup. There are links on our website, kcpw.org. Coming up next, Utah's Right to Know. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Finding out the salary of a public employee or the results of a restaurant health inspection are just a click away, thanks to the online project called Utah's Right to Know. Today on the program, we're finding out more about the Salt Lake Tribune's efforts to make public information more public, more accessible. Joining me in studio is Don Myers. He's a reporter for the Salt Lake Tribune, and he's also the site manager for utahsright.com. And Don Myers, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
I'm glad to be here, Jennifer.
And you can join our conversation as well if you've got questions or comments about public records or the Utah's Right to Know project. You can call us, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Don Myers, what prompted the Salt Lake Tribune to launch Utah's Right to Know?
Well, it was launched back around 2007, and the idea was to show Utahns, you know, what public records are available to them, and also to create sort of a, you might say, a clearinghouse where you can look up some of these, you know, commonly public records, such as employee salaries, restaurant inspections, criminal charges, and the such.
How many visits is the site getting in, say, the average month?
We get 1.5 million page views a month.
Wow.
Yes.
I mean, what was the goal when you set out in 2007? What were you kind of thinking? Is this in the ballpark of what you were thinking?
Well, I'm not too familiar with what they were thinking at the time, but we've noticed it has been a smashing success. And by comparison, I think it took Transparency Utah, the state's record site, about 2 years to get up to 250,000 page views.
Okay, so Salt Lake Tribune site, it seems to be generating a bit more traffic. What are the most popular searches that you find on the site?
Probably the most popular search is the public salaries, because a lot of people want to go on and look and see, you know, like how much do the people who work for their city make, or how much is their neighbor who's a state employee down the street make?
So these salaries range from the city level, the county level, to the state level, the courts. I mean, you can find a salary for any public employee?
Almost any public employee. I mean, there's still some that we're still trying to get, but pretty much we cover, you know, the cities, the counties, special service districts, and the such.
Now, of course, I mean, this is all public information. It's out there. But I would imagine that not everybody wants their salaries to be published. And I understand that one Utah lawmaker even tried to restrict having that salary information made public.
Yes. Craig Powell from up in Wasatch County, he was contacted by a Wasatch County official who said that Utah's Right was causing a bit of a morale problem in the office. People were coming up and saying, well, how come he gets paid more than I do and I do more work?
I guess that's not the Salt Lake Tribune's problem.
No.
We're speaking with Don Myers. He's a reporter and the site manager for UtahsRight.com. It's a project of the Salt Lake Tribune trying to get public records more publicly accessible. If you've got questions or comments about the project, feel free to join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Now, I recently saw a piece, I'm blanking on exactly how long ago, but it was fairly recently, on how much teachers in the state of Utah make. And you had taken out a few that had some pretty high salaries. So I think it was like $120,000 a year. It seemed high to me. But if you read the fine print, this salary information includes benefits as well. So I guess that's something that readers should be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. In fact, it's probably one of the more frequent complaints I get. I mean, I think if I go more than a week without somebody saying, I don't make that much money, you know, something's wrong. And what it shows on the front page is gross compensation. That is your salary, benefits, and other things. Basically, what it represents is how much you cost your employer. But if you click on the name, then you will get a breakdown. It shows, okay, this is how much it is in salaries, how much it is in benefits. And, you know, it really shows, the full cost of in personnel.
What's been the hardest part of this project for the Salt Lake Tribune? I mean, has it been the technical part, you know, getting the technology to work? Has it been acquiring this information from public entities? What's been the hardest part?
I would say probably getting the information from the public entities. Because when we started out, the transparency website didn't exist, so we had to file grandma requests with each and every agency. And for your listeners who aren't familiar, GRAMA is an acronym for the Government Records Access and Management Act, Utah's open records law. And we would try to request it in electronic format. And sometimes we would get it in electronic format, or sometimes they would just send us a printout. One entity was infamous for sending printouts because they said, well, if we send you a spreadsheet, you're going to mess it up. When in reality, it's like by sending us a printout, then we've got to try to transfer it back into an electronic format, and that just increases the potential for error.
Mm. Grandma, of course, was in dispute in 2011. House Bill 477 passed by the Utah legislature. A lot of public outcry, later repealed by lawmakers. I mean, how would, if HB 477 had stuck, how would that have affected the Utah's Right to Know project?
Well, basically, HB 477 would have turned Grandma's core principle on its head. Instead of the presumption that all records are presumed open, we would have to be making a case as to why these records should be public. And also, it would essentially change the way entities would charge for records. Essentially, you know, they would, instead of just adding on the, the actual cost of producing the record, they would pretty much throw in everything except the kitchen sink.
In addition to salary information, you've also got information about restaurant inspections, health inspections, pool inspections, criminal charges, even divorce information. I mean, what is, I'm playing the devil's advocate here, but what is the public interest in publishing information about somebody's divorce? Where is that line between public and private?
Well, first, the divorce records. You can go down to the courthouse and see, you know, who's been divorced or who's received an annulment. So basically, it's not like we're prying into something that isn't already public. And the public interest, I would say, comes from, you know, basically, you know, knowing what is going on. And also, you know, some people use it, you know, like to check out, you know, somebody they're dating to find out. It's like, okay, has this guy had any problems before? And also, I know as Judge Taylor was arguing, pointing out during the Gary Coleman hearing that, marriages are essentially sort of a matter of public record, that, that there is a record showing that these two are a married couple. So therefore, when that union is dissolved, that is also a matter of public record.
Hmm. So in addition to the individual information about somebody, you can go on and check out if I've been delinquent on my taxes or whatever. In addition to that, though, does Utah's Right to Know look at larger trends?
That's what we strive to do. We're trying to look for sort of trends to see where things are going. Because sometimes it's like you look at data that's like, if you look at a salary for 1 year, that's a nice little snapshot. But if you can try to look at it over a course of, several years, you can, start seeing a trend. It's like, is somebody getting a raise when somebody else isn't getting a raise in an organization?
You mentioned that the state is now operating its own transparency website. How is that significantly different from what Utah's Right to Know is doing? Or is it?
It's the same on the surface that they are provide, they show you employee compensation, but it's different in the fact that it was, the best way to put it is it was designed for wonks, because it's a very, clumsy system to use. I mean, if you're going to be looking up something, like the names are all in alphabetical order, and you really have to know what you're looking for to find it. Whereas Utah's Right, you don't even have to know where the person works. You can just type their name in and we will pull that information right up for you and then give you a nice easy breakdown. Or if you look at a particular agency, we can show you who makes, the most money there. Or another fun feature is click on a job title. And we will pull up everybody with that job title so you can compare. It's like, okay, so, police officers in City A make this much money, but a police officer in this other city makes, a lot more.
Hmm. We're speaking with Don Myers, reporter and site manager for UtahsRight.com. It's the Utah's Right to Know Project, sponsored by the Salt Lake Tribune. I mean, do you find that most of the inquiries are personal curiosity, or what's the motivating people, 1.5 million people, to go to your site every month?
Well, there are some people who do it for the curiosity factor. You're just wanting to know, how much people make, or see who's got a criminal charge. And I've also been told that there are employers who will use it as part of the screening process for candidates. Look to see if they have a criminal record or something, and decide it's like, okay, do I really want to hire this guy?
What's been the best part of this project for you as a reporter?
Well, basically just, getting out there and working, with Utah's, grandma law, and, helping advance the idea of open government.
And do you find that that there's been a heightened interest since this 2011 very public debate over HB 477, that, more people are investigating just what is public out there and what they can get their hands on?
Oh, absolutely, because HB 477 was a wake-up call for people that, hey, we have this law that allows us to, look at public records, look under the hood of government, see what's going on, and that there are people out there who don't want you to do that. And I know the State Records Committee has seen a significant uptick in the number of appeals that's hearing since HB 477.
So there's your proof, huh?
That's one element of the proof.
We've only got a couple seconds left, but I mean, what are you working on right now? Do you have something in the pipeline that you're excited to unveil?
Well, we're going to be unveiling a companion blog that's going to go along with Utah's Right to basically, you know, highlight open government issues in Utah and the area.
And what's it called?
Well, we're still working on that part.
Okay. Don Myers, a reporter and site manager for UtahsRight.com at the Salt Lake Tribune. You can check it out, UtahsRight.com. Don Myers, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, why women clam up when they're outnumbered by men in the boardroom. We'll get some details of a new group dynamic study coming out of BYU. Join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.